I do speak in Mankato on a regular basis, as well as a lot of other areas. Matter of fact, Mr. Nisko, our pastor, says my middle name is Wersey this week, but my official church area is Little Falls, Minnesota. It's not all that far from Mankato. Hard to keep track of. By the way, good morning. Good morning, everyone, including those on the webcast. You may have noticed this morning, looking at the speaking schedule, it's a Janssen and Anderson. It's the Lake Wobegon session here at Jekyll. For those of you who are familiar with Prairie Home Companion and Garrison Keillor, how many watch him or listen to him occasionally? I got a few out there from up there in the North Country. By the way, it is good to be down here in this warm, beautiful part of the world, being from Minnesota. And we called home a few times since we've been here, and of course, this time of the year, sometimes it can take a dip. I can remember Halloween a few years back, we had 20 inches of snow. It's not that far off, but it's been down in the 30s. I think my wife's tomato plants went to sleep for the winter, but a little nippy, so we got down here just in time. Close call. Matter of fact, the receiver was even cold this morning. Last time I was listening to Mr. Johnson, and it sounded like we had similar experiences with tents. Last time I was down here was about 35 years ago, and that was the time of the big tent. How many were here at Jekyll during the big tent era? Okay, so you've been there. Well, as I was thinking back about that, I was impressed, especially being an old Boy Scout and, you know, used to sleeping in pup tents, and you know how big those are. Come into something like that, very, very impressive. Matter of fact, I think Noah could have parked his boat there, and there'd been enough room left over for a Capel family reunion. Not sure in the last part, but... Well, after listening to Mr. Kelly's fine sermon yesterday, I think I know someone who can answer his question about why our economy is such a mess these days. It's little Johnny. He's 7 years old, and as you know, seven-year-olds know stuff. Well, Johnny knows stuff. Johnny wanted $100 very badly, don't we all? And he prayed for weeks, but nothing happened. Then he decided to write God a letter. Good idea, right? Write God a letter, requesting $100. When the postal authorities received the letter to God, USA, decided to send it to the president. The president was so amused that he instructed the secretary to send the little boy $5, little Johnny, $5. The president thought this would be a lot of money, and I think for an average seven-year-old that would be a lot of money. Well, Johnny was delighted with the $5 bill and sat down and wrote a thank you note to God, which read, "Dear God, thank you very much for sending the money. However, I notice that for some reason you sent it through Washington, D.C., and they deducted $95 in taxes." Like I said, kids know stuff. You sure you didn't want the special music corral to come back out here? We can't tell Sven and Ole jokes anymore because they're ethnic, even though I'm Swedish. So I'd cut off 90% of my repertoire. Anyway. Well, on this third day of the feast, as we heard, we would, by analogy, looking into the feast and taking a certain percentage, be somewhere in the area of maybe 300 to 400 years on in to the world tomorrow. Now, if you're a chess player, any of those that played chess, you might say that we're into the middle game. In chess, there's the opening, the beginning game, and there's what they call the end game, and there's also a middle game. And each one of them is a little different as far as strategy and tactics. Now, I'm not going to go into chess today. I'm really not that good at it. But the point is, it just kind of sets up that way. Here we are kind of heading into that middle portion of the millennium. And the kingdom's rolling along, and everybody's on board after the Ezekiel 38 and Zechariah 14. You remember those areas of Scripture. might call the period of friendly persuasion, when God has to kind of influence everybody to come down to keep the feast and take care of some malcontents there at the beginning of the millennium. Well, the deserts are blooming, and life is very, very good, with the occasional lump now and then. So what do we do now? What do we do now? Well, the Bible says a fair amount about the beginning, in Ezekiel 38 and 39 and areas like that, and some about the end of the millennium. But what about this period, this long stretch after things settle down, after, and I don't know how long it's going to take. You read Ezekiel 38 and 39, it could take decades, you know, maybe even longer than that, to kind of get everybody into the program. So we could be into it, you know, maybe 100, 200 years before things really are, you know, rolling, flowing. So what do we do for that 200-300-year period down to, you know, as we head down towards the end of the millennium, this middle section before things heat up again right at the end? Well, let's see if we can get a little bit of a glimpse this morning at this time period and what it has to say about our jobs now and what we're learning and what we'll be doing then with our new assignments in eternity. Let me tell you a little story we might call Millennium Light. It's kind of a foretaste of some good things ahead. This is the morning of sports analogies, from rollerblading to pole vaulting, and realize, Bill, I've got to talk to him. It sounds like he's quite a college athlete. Well, I was fortunate enough to attend Ambassador College back in the good old days, back in 68 to 71, when, in one sense, I remember going down there, it really felt like you were or had a slice of the millennium or the world tomorrow. When you were at Ambassador College during those years, it was a wonderful time. And I wasn't reared in the church, so this was all new to me. I came out of the University of Minnesota. And as you know and recall back at those times, it was a very socially active time in the United States, nationally. But it was still pretty quiet down at Big Sandy. I went to Big Sandy, had a chance to go to visit Brickett Wood and Pasadena a few times, but I spent my time in Big Sandy, and it was wonderful down there. They affectionately called it, the other campuses called us the country club, because we had a golf course and a lake and, you know, all those fun things, horseback riding. It was a wonderful place, thanks to Mr. Buckhammer and family who donated that land. And so I got a at a spot I was in during probably, I would say, the best of the times, or certainly in the ballpark. Had a lot of fun playing another game called basketball. I still try to play it a little bit, try to keep in shape. At least I tried to play down there. There were some great athletes at that time, some very, very good ball players, ex-college players, but had a lot of fun trying at it anyway. While I was growing up spiritually, and of course that's what you do, you'd start down at Ambassador College, you kind of get an idea with all those wonderful instructors down there trying to give you an idea what you're really all about, what life's all about, and what you really like. Because I was baptized down there. I wasn't even baptized when I went to college. So I was a rookie, a raw green rookie down there. So I had a lot of fun playing basketball. As I started to grow up spiritually, I noticed something very interesting going on. We had outside referees for our basketball games, and they were interclass, and we played the faculty, and a lot of it was a pretty high level of ball. I would say it was even higher than when I played in high school. So it was good caliber of ball. So we had good outside refs, probably a small college refs that came in. Of course, later on, Ambassador University did actually get in and play intercollegiate athletics. Had some very good ball players. By the way, your festival advisor was supposed to be here, is down in South Africa. His daughter was one of the best women basketball players in the country. I don't know if you knew that or not, but Mr. Trabig's daughter. Anyway, Sharon, she was a wonderful ball player. So anyway, we had these refs come in from the outside. And they weren't in the church. So after a while, they begin to notice something different about Ambassador College and their basketball program. Something very interesting. Not only was there good sportsmanship all around, I don't remember my 3 years there anybody really ever having an attitude problem on the court or anything. I mean, you know, we played hard basketball, but for the most part, I mean, you raise your hand when you fouled, and, you retold the line, or you heard about it. And I don't remember, like I said, anybody really getting out of line. So the ref started to notice it. It was great sportsmanship all around, players and crowd alike. Matter of fact, it was the only place on the planet that I'm probably aware of, and there may be a few others, but where the refs were cheered when they were introduced. And the others I know were Pasadena and Brick and Wood. But not a common occurrence. So Ambassador College became the highlight of their circuit, the reffing circuit. It was a much coveted campus to work. And I'm sure the word got around, but I recall a couple of guys were there just on a regular basis. Really nice guys, kind of got to know them once in a while. Afterwards, the faculty would let us imbibe a little bit. Those of us that are old enough who could have a beer, so sometimes when you have a beer with the refs, they'd stick around a little bit. Great guys. So they really expressed their appreciation for what Ambassador was all about and their desire to ref future games. And it does, the 3 years I was down there, I remember the same guys reffing most of the time. So it really wasn't an environment anywhere, probably on the planet, like Ambassador College during those years. So, in one sense, you might say good news does sell. They kind of got the bug a little bit. And it was interesting, we came to learn that winning wasn't everything. In that little foretaste of the millennium that we had down there during those years. But you know, today, what's going on right now, it's been incredible. 2 years of political theater. Less than 3 weeks, we're going to pick the most powerful leader in the history of mankind. We know God stuffs the ballot box, according to Daniel 2:21. He'll take care of all that. But you can't help but be affected by it. And as Mr. Kelly pointed out, what's going on as far as the economy is concerned. Of course, it's a global economy. And we all wonder about the work of God. It sounds like we had a wonderful offering, but things to pray about. But, you know, God's work has to be done. It's in his hands. He's going to take care of all this. I don't know what he has in mind. None of us do, but we will see. I digress. Get out there. We live in an age that is hyper-competitive. It's a time of winners and losers. And the losers are really made to feel like losers. You've probably all seen this sign. You know, kids are doing that these days. It's unfortunate. And unfortunately, who remembers the bridesmaids? You know, those that come in second. You know, the second teams. I can't remember who won the World Series last year, much less who came in second. It wasn't the Minnesota Twins. I didn't follow it that closely. Much less third or fourth. And sadly, there is, as they say on a given day, not a scintilla's difference between first and second, a lot of these. Unless, of course, your name is Usain Bolt. If you watch the Olympics, that is, he's from another planet, I think. Man, I've never seen in a sprint like that, that kind of separation for those that watch the Olympics. But for the most part, most of the races are down where they're microseconds, in many cases so. Years ago, I remember Mr. Gerald Waterhouse. I had the pleasure of playing golf with him a couple times and came out to my areas when I was in the ministry full time. And, of course, Festival Elder's your brother, wonderful golfer. You know, he almost went on the tour, very close, a wonderful golfer. But I remember him saying he thought golf would be the game of the millennium. Some of you remember that. It wasn't because it was holy either. They say the pun is the highest form of humor. In Britain, anyway. I got to throw in one of those once in a while. Anyway, in golf, it's you against the course. For you golfers, you're going out this afternoon. It's total personal responsibility. No excuses. Of course, last time I checked, golf courses don't cheat or play dirty either. Unless the weather's bad, you can blame somebody. So the whole world today is built on an ultra-conservative model. Whether you're talking about sports, entertainment, business, or politics. A very, very competitive world that we're living in. And as a result, people have no life. As they say, get a life. Well, I have no life. I remember a young man in high school mentioned a good friend of mine's son came up one day. He was like a sophomore in high school. Daddy says, I got no life. you know, he was studying, playing ball, and, you know, it's, he had no life, no time to do anything, to relax and sit, kick back, enjoy watching Mr. Kelly rollerblade. It's a two-income, in many cases, many households, 60-hour work week. Some people have two and even three jobs that I know of. It's a workaholic environment with little time left for what's really important, at least in the USA and other parts of the world. Europe certainly is a little different that way. Why, even little five-year-old children, little kids, now both boys and girls, are up at 4 o'clock in the morning to travel over 50, 60 miles just to get ice time. And that's not in Canada, where that's a religion. I'm talking about hockey right in Minnesota, my hometown. We used to have teams come off from Minneapolis to rent ice time in Litchfield, a town of 6,500, because they couldn't get ice time in Minneapolis. So their parents were bringing these little squirts, little peewees out to play hockey, you know, traveling 4 or 5 in the morning to practice. I mean, you know, I like sports, but, you know, it's gotten over the top. They have camps now for everything. I'm sure Mr. Johnson probably went to a pole vaulting camp sometime or another. I mean, you don't get to the level he's at. Like I said, that's quite an accomplishment. But they got camps for everything these days. They've even got camps to help you cope with the camps. And I hate to say it, they even have camps now for learning how to tell Sven and Ole jokes. Yeah, sure, yeah, betcha. Right there in good old Lake Wobegon, Minnesota. By the way, my wife's hometown. She's from Holdingford, Minnesota. It says right there, gateway to Lake Wobegon. Where all the women are strong. All the men are, well, you know the rest. At least according to Garrison Keillor. It's too much. We're overloaded. We're living in an era and a time that a few could foresee. I think most of us are saying, time out. That's one of the reasons we need these wonderful days to kind of be able to kick back. And it's really wonderful to be able to have, like on Sabbath, you know, to be able to sleep in a little bit and enjoy and relax at the feast. I know there was a time early on when, you know, people didn't get together that often that you had, and sometimes two or three services a day. But it's really nice now to be able to relax and kind of get out of the world a little bit. And our little slice, like it was at Ambassador, of the millennium here, of the world tomorrow, the wonderful world tomorrow. So it's over the top for both kids and parents. It's just, you know, what's the big thing now in the political scene? Hockey moms, soccer moms. You know, they just, it's too much. Too much. It's got to be a better way. Got to be a better way when there are no wars. Life is as good as it will be, like in the world tomorrow. So why is everybody chasing the unholy grail of success and fulfillment, of winning, like we mentioned? Well, Satan's one obvious answer. We just kept a holy day, talked about him. He's certainly a factor as he goads mankind into an out-of-balance, extremist mentality that promises success and fulfillment. Excuse me. The problem is, as we know, it is only a short-term fix. A partial fix for what really ails mankind. And here's why. Let's go over to Psalm 75. We're going to get into the Bible. I'll be reading from the New International Version, by the way, and maybe quoting the New King James. Psalm 75, verse 6. Here's why man hasn't got a life, why he can't find success. As Mick Jagger said, can't get no satisfaction. He's still around. It says, no one from the east or the west or from the desert can exalt a man or promote, as it says in the New King James. Grant success would be another way of putting it. But it is God who judges, who brings one down and exalts another. In other words, it's God who grants success. He'll place a man or a woman someday in the highest offices of the land. It's up to him. He has a plan he's controlling. And all the way down, everything else that man considers success in life ultimately comes from God. So here we see David framing the answer that, indeed, there's only one way to get a life. God says, you please me, and I'll give you success. Make you feel good, like life, make life fun and fulfilling, like here at the feast, like we do every year. And even better, make it joyful. One of the fruits, you ever wonder why, you ever notice, after love, which is the most important fruit of all, the Spirit, God puts joy and peace second. There's a reason for that. And he puts balance last, like he says, go back and review and keep everything in order. But joy right after. If you're a loving person, you're becoming love. Not just loving, becoming love. God is love. And then he says, from that flow, joy and peace. One is contentment of the mind, the other contentment of the heart. And you put those two together, you got it as good as you can get it. And that's what God and Christ have done forever that way. I like to call it back ever. I don't know if that's a word, but it describes that a forever, you got back ever. So Christ and the Father have been living back ever in that way. He says he'll give us that deep down satisfying fun that lasts, not the short term fix that the world is going after. And you ever wonder why people are hooked on drugs? They're looking for a better high. We got the best high there is, Jekyll Island high. Now, those guys out, our brothers and sisters out in Steamboat and some of those places up in the mountains, if they got a Rocky Mountain high, that's fine too. We'll take this one. They're all good, year in and year out. And God grants us the real high that man is looking for. And it may or may not include a lot of money. Remember what it says in Proverbs 30, verse 8 and 9? It says, it'll be just enough, not too much, not too little. As he points it, too much so that we forget God, too little that he steals and messes things up. God knows just what we need. It's the allotment that will give us that, especially for the converted mind, that wonderful sense of fulfillment. Christ confirms this over in Matthew 6:33, one of my favorite scriptures. It's one of those mountaintop scriptures. I think one of the most powerful, life-directing, perspective-giving scriptures in the Bible. You need perspective, and we all need perspective. We need that compass that reorients us, you know, daily. This is one of them, especially during tough economic times. Verse 25, Matthew 6. Therefore, I tell you, do not worry about your life and what you will eat or drink or about your body and what you will wear. Is not life more important than food and the body more important than clothes? I know it's tough. You know, when Mr. Johnson was going through, he lost jobs. Many of you have lost jobs, possibly over the Sabbath or downsizing or all the other types of activities that go on these days in the business world. I've been involved in the business world for last 30 years. My brothers and I run our family company, so we know what it's like to make a payroll and keep the doors open, as they say, try to keep a going concern. It can be a challenge. But God says here, don't worry about those things. The greatest barometer of the economy is the work of God. God says, look it, I'm going to keep the doors open financially, and this community has chosen Manasseh and the rest of Israel to be the home base for the work of God. To feed the rest of the world is kind of like Joseph's grain bin in the modern age, the spiritual analogy here in the end times. He's made Israel the modern grain bin. Spiritual grain bin for the rest of the world. He's going to keep the doors open. We're going to have enough. Now, we may have to tighten our belts and do some things, you know, even at headquarters, but it's interesting. He's given us the most efficient way to preach the gospel ever imagined by mankind. It's called the internet. And the things that we're looking into right now really are, off the charts as far as what we can do. With about 6.5 billion people out there, we've got a lot of folks to get around to. And he's given us a tool that can, you know, get us there. So here he says, he goes on to say, look at the birds of the air. They do not sow nor reap nor store away in barns, and yet your heavenly Father feeds them. Are they not more valuable? Are you not more valuable than they? Who of you worrying can add a single hour to his life? Perspective again. Beautiful perspective. In verse 33, he goes down to finish off here. He says, but seek you first his kingdom of God. That's what we're here doing. We're visualizing, was pointed out, the kingdom of God. We're experiencing, we're tasting it. We're feeling it and enjoying it and understanding what real success is all about. Psalm 133, I think it is. Brothers dwelling together in unity. Friends for eternity. Remember what Christ said? To me, one of the most exciting and moving scriptures in the entire Bible, read at Passover, where Christ said, I no longer call you servants, I call you friends. We're going to be the friends of God for the rest of eternity. Think about your best buddy, your best pal. That's the way it's going to be with 20 to 40, 60, 80 billion people. You're going to have time to get to know them all. It's an incredible thought. You can put Romans 8:28 in there. It's one of my favorite scriptures. It says, all things work for the good of those that love God and are called according to his purpose. Fits right in there. It says, regardless, it's a spiritual insurance policy. God says, you submit to me. You do your Micah, 6:8 work. That's kind of what does God require. You do those things on a regular basis. God says, I'll take care of you. We'll get through this. The work's got to be done. And if we don't get through it, that means the work's done. Pretty simple. Now back to the mid-millennium. When it's all set up, the living is easy, Satan's locked up in the spiritual pokey. As people's basic needs of security and sustenance, the things that have been wanting for the last 6,000 years, no war, good jobs, providing the necessities and some wants of life for all the planet are satisfied, basically. I said, well illustrated by the last fine messages we've heard the last several days here. But now, the human race starts to look around for more. Starts to look around for more. How do we know that? Mid-millennium, that's a long time off. How do we know that man living in the midst of paradise, utopia, will see more and want more and thereby possibly run into some spiritual traps and trouble 300-400 years into the millennium? How do we know that? Well, there are two very sobering. There's not a lot of information in the Bible, but there are some indicators. Two very sobering incidents, one back deep in history and the other far into the future, that give us some clues as to why this might happen and what the challenges might be in the middle game of the world tomorrow. Turn back to Ezekiel chapter 28. Verse 11. I've read this many times. Here we see a being, a lament about the king of Tyre, but we soon realize that it's not talking about a human being, not the real king of Tyre. It was a type. It says, you were the model of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty, and you were in Eden in the garden of God. Well, it's not Adam and Eve, therefore by Minnesota map, that there was only one other being there, two other beings, certainly. And became Christ as well as we know as Satan the devil, the serpent. And it goes on to talk about all that he had going for him. You talk about a resume, a dossier, if you were going to line things up. You look at what Lucifer started with. He had it all. You talk about success. Success incarnate. But in verse 17 it says, your heart became proud on account of your beauty. You corrupted your wisdom because of your splendor. And so I throw you to the earth. You know the rest of the story. Isaiah 14. Verse 12. Here it's a little more direct. It says, "How you have fallen from heaven, O morning star, son of dawn. You've been cast down to the earth, you who once laid low the nations. And you said in your heart," now this gets into something that's hard to imagine, "but you've said in your heart, I will ascend to heaven." Satan at one point got to the stage mentally where he thought he could actually challenge God. It's hard to comprehend, seeing he was a created being, but it happened. Then it goes on to describe that. He said he would ascend above the tops of the clouds, and I will make myself like the Most High. And he even goes, I think it's even stronger than that in the Hebrew. When and where did these incidents take place or happen in prehistory? Well, we know they were probably well before the recreation. And we understand from Genesis 1:3, you know, after the chaos and confusion, the tohu and bohu as it has in the Hebrew, that God recreated, refurbished, cleaned up the mess that took place in Genesis 1:2. So we know it took some place well before then, because we meet the antagonist of Ezekiel and Isaiah 14 in the garden as Satan the devil. So he'd already gone through the change. It wasn't Lucifer at that point. We also know that it was well after the original creation of 1:1 when God originally created the universe, because we see him as the cause of the tohu and bohu sometime back in there. It's certainly implied over in Isaiah 45, verse 18. You can check on that. So in a sense, metaphorically, we could say that it was mid-millennium in Lucifer comes Satan's life. First midlife crisis, maybe. But it was long after Lucifer's creation day, I think it's fair to say. But probably long before God refurbished the earth and allowed Satan back in as an interim landlord, we know that, small l, on a conditional restrained basis. He couldn't play tohu and bohu again, like he did in Genesis 1:2. So we could say by analogy that about the set of ideal circumstances existed for Lucifer, as will exist in the mid-millennium. I think the analogy could be drawn. You had the perfect government, perfect leadership, all around. And most of all, Satan had no Satan, just like in the world tomorrow. And yet Satan was tempted to change. And Satan has a mind like ours. He has emotions. You read through and you study the demon world. You study Satan. He feels. There's going to be weeping and gnashing and teeth. There's jealousy and envy and all those horrible things. Before that, I mean, he had the normal range of emotions. Very creative. He's brilliant. I don't think his mind is a lot different. He's just smarter than we are. He's very crafty. We know that. So he, as Lucifer, was created in a perfect government in paradise. No Satan and the horrors, no horrors of the tribulation or Armageddon as a dim, fading historical memory. Think back. How well do you remember 1600, 1700? You know, when the Mayflower came over? I don't remember back there too well. So if you're 300-400 years into the millennium, them remembering Armageddon and those events pictured by trumpets, yeah, stuff starts to fade. Generations change. Over in Isaiah 30, in verse 21, it tells us something very interesting about this period of time. It says, whether you turn to the right, and we can get back and read the context here, but it does, we know, refer to the world tomorrow, a time beyond. Whether you turn to the right or to the left, your ears will hear a voice behind you saying, this is the way, walk you in it. There's no devil there. You know, people can't say, the devil made me do it. You're not going to have that. But it does say they're going to be turning to the right or the left. There will be temptation of a different type. Otherwise, why do you need somebody there saying, don't go that way? Right? So there's going to be some challenges. There might be some of this lack of satisfaction of the 1 John 2:16 type, where it talks about the lust of the eyes, the lust of the flesh, and the pride of life. Now, Satan had some of that. I don't know if he had lust of the flesh. There's a spiritual component, comparable trait in a spirit being like Satan had, the lust of the flesh, but certainly the lust of the eyes. It talks about his pride. Similar things were working on his mind and heart, just like it will be on human beings during this time. Waiting to be incubated and hatched. It severely points to the critical spiritual fact that long-term satisfaction and therefore true happiness is contingent upon something that the Father and Christ experienced back ever for eternity. That peace and harmony and happiness, the things we're learning about and that we, you know, hopefully come and bring each year as we grow up spiritually and mature, that each feast is more joyful as we mature. There's more peace and harmony and happiness. The things that Christ and the Father experienced back ever were only achieved, and this is the key, this is the part that is so hard, it's so counterintuitive for human beings. And that's why the Passover is such an incredible ceremony, to realize somebody as great as God, and you start to try to get perspective and ask how smart God is and how powerful he has created the universe. He comes down as a man and washes our feet and says, I want to be your friend for the rest of eternity. No longer a servant. That kind of humility is mind-blowing. And yet it was that humility and sharing the true selflessness they had between each other back ever that we're somehow trying to capture now and grow into. And we know that's the only thing that will create that sense of satisfaction that Mick Jagger can't find. In human beings, its ultimate expression is the total submission of the human will. We just celebrated a day called the Feast of Trumpets that more than anything else shows the power of the human will. And we're all amazed as we go through that day knowing that we will be changed when part of that is fulfilled, the Armageddon part that comes after. And we ask ourselves, how could somebody like me who lives next door to me, that I went to school with, that I work with, possibly related to, could turn around and shake their fist at the creator of the universe? It's hard to fathom. Almost impossible. I'll move on here. So that's what God is all about. And we're learning to capture some of that humility that translates into joy and peace and harmony as we work through our spiritual boot camp. Now let's jump forward in time quickly here, past the mid-millennium point, the middle game, and let's go to a most unusual moment in future history, to the end of the millennium, and continue to try and understand what can happen in the mid-millennium, in the middle game. 1,000 years of divine beneficent rule and a perfect government has been visited upon mankind at this point. And they have witnessed during this time their own relatives, friends, going through the program and being changed into young gods who then become employed in that most marvelous of governmental systems, the kingdom of God. And yet I repeat, something very strange happens on the way to the white throne judgment. Let's go there and remember the mid-millenarians. Easy for you to say, right? And right down to the end, those that are changing and going along and becoming part of the team will be early on. But There'll be people coming in all along, right down to the end, in God's employ. They themselves, who've had possibly up to 100 years, we don't know, depending on how long it takes. It's a very individual thing. God knows best. By the best teachers in history. Some of them will be us. And this is all going to happen over that 1,000 years, as we read. Those Isaiah 30, 2021 teachers we just heard. Turn over to Revelation 20 as we head down the back stretch here. In verse 7, it says, when the 1,000 years are over, Satan will be released from prison and will go out to deceive the nations in the four corners of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them for battle. In a number, they're like the sands of the seashore. Now, that's a big number. It's a big number. The devil who deceived them says, came out to deceive them, says, was thrown into the lake of fire, and we know all the rest there. And what happens? Sad ending. Very sad ending. Now here, compare to the last 1,000 years, after Satan is let out for the short time, for a major mischief session, it's a short one, thankfully. Remember, Satan is not present that 1,000 years, but he'll be being taught about. That 1,000 years, the teachers, the Isaiah 30, 20 crew, will be teaching about him. It won't be out of earshot. He'll be gone, but not his memory and what he did and how that could influence people. It'll be part of the training program. And it'll come right up to the end of the millennium, and then these four-quarter rebels themselves will be being taught this. And at this time, I'm sure they'll be getting it in both ears from both us. And as Satan, as he's released, and possibly, you know, his demons, they'll be working on the other side, the sands of the sea. There'll be a lot of folks out there. Now, to be fair, Revelation 20 does not say that every last physical human being. It says a lot of them will be. Will join the rebellion. But it'll be a lot of folks. No doubt about that. Also, think about it. They're going to have war. They're going to have weapons. They're going to be organized. And they're going to have to do this all in the middle of a perfect society. 1,000 years worth of it. Seems that God is certainly going to have to allow that. There's no doubt about it. It's this last diabolical gasp. And we know there are going to be a lot of people working the streets of the Isaiah 30 type, trying to hold this down. For some reason it happens. We know its causes. We know the spiritual forces, the nature of man we mentioned earlier. 1 John 3:16 will be there. Lust of the flesh, of the eyes, pride of life. They are powerful. They create what we see along with Satan's urgings and influence, as we say, the Feast of Trumpets, a most incredible period of time and events. And you wonder how man could do that. So that will be alive and well right there at the end. Like I said, this is a spiritually acquired taste. It doesn't come easily or quickly. That's why it takes many, many years. And allowing up, God's allowing up to 100 years the way it appears. Unlike the quick fix, fun now, pay later approach of Satan, which like drugs demand an ever bigger fix, there is no true satisfaction, unfortunately. So God will allow testing. We know that throughout the 1,000 years. Remember what it says in Isaiah 30, 20. We didn't read the scripture before, but it says, the bread of adversity, though I allow the bread of adversity and the water of affliction. We know there will be trials throughout this middle period, though Satan is not there. And that coupled with the 1 John 2:16 drives that inherit the human mind and heart that we're told is desperately wicked, is enmity against God, are enough to stir the pot and obviously result in what we see at the end of the millennium. Hard to fathom, but it will take place. So, our job will be to direct the energy and the effort into spiritually profitable thought and activity. which ultimately leads to spiritual character. Basic theme that we go through, certainly, in Unleavened Bread, the beginning Holy Days. And there was satisfaction without more. God's way is not like drugs. It satisfies with what you have. That's an incredible insight. And it's one given to very few people on the planet nor in history. Satisfaction without more. The overarching goal is still the same in the millennium. We know that. It's to make gods. Though the playing field might be a bit different then, the game and its goals and rules are still the same in the middle game. So what are we going to be doing when this mid-period of the feast metaphorically rolls around in the millennium? It will primarily be helping people find and maintain utopian balance. Isaiah 30, 21 type. Remember it says this way, right and left, balance. The last fruit of the Spirit that when done properly keeps everything else in alignment and directs back up towards love and the peace and joy that follow immediately thereupon. Spiritual perspective so that the success and satisfaction in the incredible environment of God's kingdom and Christ's rule, which will be highly developed by then, will be the right kind. The deeply spiritual kind, better than the best drug. Not the shallow, physical, pseudo-satisfying counterfeit that Satan palms off in markets today. That's what we're up against. Or that human nature can long for naturally, even in the wonderful world tomorrow. In one sense, God calls us to become the unnaturals. After all, Satan lived in paradise, and it wasn't enough for him. And he had no Satan. So the challenge will still be there well into the middle game of the millennium. But when we do our job right in that day and leading up to it, the real refs of life, those Isaiah 30, 20 kind, which we'll be a part of, that refing team, will be cheered for the rest of eternity. Go, ambassadors for Christ.